Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Been set there in.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. One thing you can count on in this world is the D.C. press corps to live down to our expectations, and they have lived down to those expectations yet again in the wake of the Covenant School mass murder yesterday in Nashville, with three kids dead, three adults associated with the school dead. Yeah,
the schoolmaster, the head of the school, excuse me, a substitute teacher and a custodian.
And this is how ABC News had it.
Oh, boy.
State of Tennessee earlier this month passed and the governor signed a bill that banned transgender medical care for minors, as well as a law that prohibited adult entertainment, including male and female impersonators, after a series of drag show controversies in that state.
So the ban on mutilating kids and drag queen story hour is the proximate cause of the Covenant School shooting, because the individual who killed all those people was a boy identifying as a girl.
Or was it a girl identifying as a boy.
Yeah, because there's identifying
a lot of
as a boy.
Pictures out there of her dressing up as a male.
So that's the proximate cause, because you had a trans shooter.
Well, NBC handled it a little differently. They're talking to the police chief, John Drake, Lester Holt.
So you've also said that Hale identified as trans. Do you believe there is a connection to that?
We feel that she identifies as trans, but we're still in the initial investigation into all of that and if it actually played a role into this incident. As we know more, we'll definitely make that known, but right now we're unsure if that actually played a role.
Well, they reportedly
recovered a
manifesto.
Yeah.
And that Police Chief Drake went on to say that resentment may have played a part in the shooting.
She did text her middle school friend before the shooting saying, "I'm just letting you know that I'm dying today. I can't take it here." And her friend said, "No, you have so much more life to live." And she said, I don't want to live. And didn't mention anything about being trans or being discriminated against or anything like that. They're also looking into the fact, because she attended school there, and she might not have had a great experience when she was at the school. But in her manifesto, there were other schools on the list. Here's the police chief.
It does. It has, in the initial investigation, we've turned it over to the FBI. We've looked over it as well. And it indicates that there was going to be shootings at multiple locations, and the school was one of them. There was actually a map of the school detailing surveillance, entry points, and how this was going to be carried out on this day.
Right. Well, she's 28 years old. The Covenant School in Tennessee is K through 6.
Right.
A little bit of a gap.
And
from
a little
the
bit
time
of a
she,
long grudge.
She attended.
Yeah.
And by the way, there's some chilling video, police or surveillance video, security camera video from the school that police have released, and it shows her shooting her way in and then walking the halls with a rifle looking for people to murder.
And they said that she just gunned down people indiscriminately as she was walking down the hall.
She targeted random students in the school, just whoever and persons, whoever she came in contact with, she fired rounds. In this incident, we had three adults.
And then, you know, three were killed. 2 9-year-olds, an 8-year-old who was about to turn 9, and then the 3 employees.
So when a white person commits one of these horrific shootings, it's white supremacy. It's the poison of whiteness. When a trans person murders 6 people, the fault lies with the Tennessee legislature and governor for passing a law banning transgender, quote unquote, treatments for minors and banning or restricting drag queen story hour. Do I have that right? Because that's what ABC News had it. That's how they had it.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
And you can't have a discussion of violence in general in America without the left trotting out their tropes, and nobody is more used to trotting out tropes than White House spokeshuman Karine Jean-Pierre. Okay. Here's what the big guy, through his spokeshuman, had to say yesterday.
We must do more, and he wants Congress to act, because enough is enough. In his State of the Union, the president called on Congress to do something to stop the epidemic of gun violence, tearing families apart, tearing communities apart. How many more children have to be murdered before Republicans in Congress will step up and act to pass the assault weapons ban?
So just so we're clear, so it's Republicans in control of state government in Tennessee. That's part of the problem. Republicans on the Hill who won't ban guns. That's the other part of the problem. So it's banning trans treatments, in quotation marks, for minors, and it's not banning guns. Those are the problems with America, with our culture, and that's what leads to these mass shootings. Just so you understand the left's position, because they provided it very neatly for us yesterday in the wake of this horror. Trans treatment bans for minors, 10 states. 10 states have them now. It's not just Tennessee. It's Florida, it's Georgia, it's Alabama, it's Arizona, it's Utah, it's South Dakota, it's Iowa. And another 30 states are considering similar legislation for all the obvious reasons we've discussed on this show at some length. But again, the need to shoehorn that into the coverage, it's a real sickness, not just the gender dysphoria or dysmorphia, but the mentality of the left in this country, as illustrated by the White House spokeshuman, as illustrated by ABC News. It's a real sickness.
Did you see what our president did yesterday? He'd heard about the shooting, and he was speaking in the East Room with a group of, you know, because it's Women's Heritage Month or whatever this is. And women business owners were there. And instead of being a serious man and coming out and, you know, addressing the issue and, you know, offering his condolences, but of course he said, you know, the assault weapons ban needs to be in place. He did this first. He talked about chocolate chip ice cream.
My name is Joe Biden. I'm Dr. Joe Biden's husband.
Oh, so old.
And I ate Jenny's ice cream, chocolate chip. I came down because I heard there was chocolate chip ice cream. By the way, I have a whole refrigerator full upstairs. I think I'm kidding. I'm not. God. Ben, how are you, pal? One of the best guys in the United States Congress, Ben Cardin. Folks, welcome to the White House. It's a delight to have you all here. And who are those good-looking kids back there?
Creepy.
They're your kids, all 4 of them? Well, stand up, guys.
It's just the shenanigans that go on. And then, later, all of a sudden he got serious and talked about the kids who were gunned down at school.
Paul and Carrie, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, guys. You know, I find this very similar to what the Daily Herald picked up on, the Tribune. Even Pritzker attended the the Lake in the Hills Bakery, the Uprising Cafe that was forced to close. I think she's got a GoFundMe now. I don't know if she's open or closed, but I think last week she said she closed, and it's all due to the violence and the opposition to her quote-unquote community. It has nothing to do with the fiscal mismanagement or lack of foot traffic or
she doesn't have any customers.
Interior product that she offered. And nothing to do with those things. It's all to do with the violence and the opposition, of course.
Yeah, what was the violence?
They broke a window.
There was no violence.
Well, a window was broken.
This was
for the first one, but she's had other drag shows after that, that nothing happened at all.
Exactly.
But the thing is,
that's what I was going to say. I don't know if you're privy to that information. She sponsored several drag shows in an effort to, Hail Mary in order that she survived, and that didn't even work. So, of course, it's everybody else's fault.
It's not market feedback. It's persecution.
She's in a poor location, and everybody interviewed her, and at the end of every interview, she just admitted, if you listen to it, she said, "Well, we don't have any customers anymore. I can't keep the customer base I used to have. Was upset with the drag queen show, so that base is gone."
Well,
so that happens.
Alienate your customers. That's bad for business. This just in, Dan in Lake Zurich. Hey, Dan.
Good morning. I just wanted to... hello?
Yep, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to know if they know these guns were acquired legally or illegally yet, because in Chicago, there's all these shootings all the time with illegal guns, and you never hear about it. And it should be the same way with any shooting. If it's illegal guns, it's illegal. It's, why make it nationwide news? This stuff just... bugs me because it's always an attack on the Second Amendment as soon as it happens.
That's my point. Police say two were purchased legally. Two that they know of, they're checking on the third. Were purchased legally. Everybody listening? Anybody listening to that?
Well, but understand, the left just comes over the top. They shouldn't be legal to own.
You're right.
We just want to ban all the guns because that'll solve it. Tony in Downers Grove.
Well, I wish they would get it straight, because on several occasions they were saying it was a trans woman. If it's a trans woman, it's a man posing as a woman. They didn't say it was a woman who thinks she's a trans male. They were saying trans woman. Many of the news outlets were doing that. So at least get it straight so we know which one is which.
Well, it's hard to keep score.
I know. Well, the only thing I could... They interviewed the neighbor who talked about when they were little kids, he and she used to play basketball together. But I don't know if he adopted the he/she. But then on her Facebook, she has he/him pronouns.
Yeah,
and
it's a woman.
It's a woman being a man,
identifying as a man. That's what we have here.
Yes.
Yeah. The name. They think the name that she used, her alter ego is Aiden or something.
Yeah. Aiden. And her name's Haley. But only 1% of biological females are mass shooters. 1%.
Right. I mean, obviously, as we know, women commit very few violent crimes compared to men. We know this.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer. On AM 560. The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission: to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We were talking about the terrible occurrence in Nashville yesterday, the murder of six people at Covenant School by apparently a former student who is woman, 28 years old, that I or was, she was taken out by police, woman who identified as a man. By the way, when police rolled up, too.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
She opened fire on them.
Yeah, the call came out at 10:13 a.m., she was dead by 10:27. It took them 14 minutes to get there. They were in the foyer, and they heard shots being fired upstairs. Two officers, I'll tell you their names in a little bit, but they just ran up. And compare that to Uvalde, where they just sat there for more than an hour and listened to this gunman just rattle off and kill people. I mean, sharp contrast between the way the two police departments handled that. So kudos to them for being brave and doing their job.
And as we were talking about, as I understand it from the left, this could have been prevented with fewer guns and more drag queen story hours. But that's not the way it is in Tennessee, and that's the fault of or in D.C., and that's the fault of Republicans. That's the left's position in summary. Maybe there's something else going on in the country, as we have, unfortunately, have to cover these things often. This survey out, Wall Street Journal NORC survey, NORC at the University of Chicago, finds, looking at trends, too, it's interesting because they look at where these questions, the answers to these questions were in 98, in 2019, and in 2023. And all the things that provide the formation of strong communities, people of character and engagement, are going down. And the only thing that's going up in terms of what Americans value is cash. Percent who say these values are very important to them. Patriotism. This is all age groups. This is, survey-wide. Patriotism. 38% of Americans, patriotism is important to them. That's down from 70 25 years ago. Almost cut in half. Religion, 39%. That's down from 62 25 years ago. Pretty big declines.
Yeah, it's enormous. Come on. Well, what are we teaching our kids at school to be unpatriotic? Oh, I don't know. Maybe last year we didn't have Veterans Day because we had to get people to vote.
Having children for is this important for people under the age of 30. Only 30% say having children is important. That's down from 59%. Actually, I think the number for people under 30 is even lower than that. I think that actually was, 23% of adults under 30 said patriotism is important. And only 23% of adults under 30 said that having children was important. There's your future.
Oh, boy.
1 in 5 people under 30 think that love of country is important and that children are important.
1 in 5.
That's not great. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Here we are with my sort of favorite pull forward from the Roman historian Livy. We're in that place, I keep referencing, where we can tolerate neither our vices nor their cures.
Well, it's such the look at me generation, and that's all because of social media. Mm. God, if you hang out with teenage kids, all they do, they're on their phone, they're looking at their faces, they're checking out other people's faces. They're not living. They're not socializing like we used to. They don't care.
This is interesting as well. Tolerance for others.
Okay.
Deemed very important by 80% of Americans as recently as 4 years ago. That's fallen to 58%. Tolerance for others. That requires a little bit more scratching below the surface. But, I just shut you out or shut you up.
Right. That's how they're allegedly tolerant, because they're not. They're barbaric.
Mm-hmm. hard work also is on the decline in terms of importance. Money increases. We've seen the importance of money has increased. 43% say money is very important to them. That's up from 31% 25 years ago. So I want more money. I want less community involvement. I don't want children.
Yeah.
I don't care much about my country. I don't believe in God, and I'm not going to work very hard. But give me more money.
More money. So God, country, family is out the door with this next generation coming up.
Yeah, money. Well, you know, that's what we bought into. We talk about buying the rope to hang ourselves. I mean, you know, Marx had an insight there, and replacing God with materialism.
Yeah.
And you know, the associated isms you were talking about, narcissism. Yeah, that's how a civilization ceases to, maybe not completely ceases to exist, but certainly ceases to be the model for existence. Mary Kay, Western Springs, you're in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Bless you, Amy. Gee.
Thank you. We don't have a cough button. Sorry, guys. Okay. We're still working on the studio here.
Yeah, I hope you, you know, you might have kids someday. You're not, you know, have some kids. Come on, populate this. Come on, please. So,
no.
Well, I mean, not populate.
Procreate.
Did you say copulate or
procreate? Replace yourself.
He's
going to get an AI to replace him.
Yeah, exactly.
Come on, you're only 50, 50 and a half or whatever you are. Nice lady contacted me yesterday, school psychologist. She and I talked for an hour about let's just keep letting the kids, the teachers tell the kids they can be trans. Let's just be trans. You know, if you're, you know, they just, you know, the kids feel safe talking to the teachers and, you know, that's the goal, right? Make sure the kids are comfortable telling the teachers that they're gay, they're this and they're that. You know, there have been gay kids forever.
Yes,
you know?
There have been.
I mean, we were in high school. Come on. What, you guys, the whole, you know, OPRF, I went there. What a place. 4,000 kids in 1979 when I started there. And what a place, you know. It was seriously like a college campus when I started. You know, we had Latin offered and we had, you know, we had the burnouts hanging out on the mall. I mean, it was such a different time. It was a nice time, you know. I mean, I got a college. I didn't go to college. I went to COD. My employer paid for my college. I was
good
down at the SIBO when I was 17. That's how Sean and I bonded. You know, we're both down there being at the Merck and the SIBO.
And
you know, then I got into finance.
Not to cut your biography short, but and so
sorry.
So and this is and so your perspective on growing up the way that you did, sort of, if it sounds like you were on the in the cast of Freaks and Geeks. But anyway, so how that relates to what we saw yesterday, these horrors that we've continued to see, and some of the survey data that we were just going over.
Just breaks my heart, you know. I mean, it's a sad. We live in a sad time, and it's just getting sadder. And you know, I try to stay positive. Tell people to, you know, I mean, you know, I don't know what else to say or what to do except, you know, get out there, folks, and come to the school board vote on Tuesday. Let's try anyway to get some of our people a seat at the table here, because they're not right wingers. I heard somebody say that the other day. It's like what constitutes a right winger anyway?
I mean, the headline on the Tribune was conservatives are trying to take over school boards.
Thanks for the comment.
It's so sinister. That was a headline. Oh my God.
Right. I mean, this is, you know, boogeyman politics. That's what the left does, and that's what their comm shop, which is, you know, the Chicago Press Corps, the D.C. Press Corps, that's what they do. And I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of sobering data here, or data that should be received in a sobering fashion. And, you know, the backdrop of this, the sort of violence you saw yesterday, I mean, you think about it. We unfortunately, we've had to talk about this a lot, but think about it again. Just like in Newtown, think about where a person is, where they are, where they would execute an 8-year-old.
Oh, I know.
I mean, think about where the depths of depravity to which that person has sunk, the soullessness, the, dare I say, evil.
And I know.
And you think, the you meaning the left, and the left thinks you're going to pass a law to deal with that? Talk about delusion.
There's always already laws on the book. And not speaking non sequiturs, but I did want to get these officers named out there. Rex Engelbert, he was a 4-year veteran, and Officer Michael Collazo. They're the two officers who ran up and gunned down. They exchanged fire, too, with the gunwoman and killed her. Ran to the action instead of away from it. And it took 14 mm-hmm. minutes from arrival. Well, from when the call was made to when the shot happened. And mm-hmm. You know how I told you that she talked to her friend before she did this? She did say this. My family doesn't know what I'm about to do. One day this will make more sense. I've left more than enough evidence behind, but something bad is about to happen today. Goodbye.
Tom in Deer Park.
Hey, Dan and Amy, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I don't disagree with anything I've heard you say this morning, and there's a lot of explanations, a lot of things we don't know. I'm very much pro-2A, very much against banning of any type of weapon, very much monocausal explanations for the blame. But one thing, getting into the weeds, one thing that you know that animates me the most is the post-truth era that we're living in, and specifically how it's happened to the right, which is my camp. And the reason why I listen to this radio station and tune in and out is how I hear the retconning of history and the absolute demolishment of truth for some sort of populist narrative, specifically that of Donald Trump. I wonder if you're kind to take my call, and I wonder if you'd be kind enough to address that after you hang up on me.
Well, I mean, you know, thanks for the call, Tom, I guess. You know, all roads lead back to Trump. The post-truth era, I mean, yes, to some extent, that's true. And, you know, who are the perpetrators of propaganda and falsehoods? Well, that's an ongoing argument, isn't it? And I guess Tom from Deer Park thinks Trump is the main culprit. I do not. I disagree with Trump, and there have been many disagreements over the last 7 years. Those are ignored by never-Trumpers like Tom, who think that I'm flacking for Donald Trump or flacking for some populist narrative. You're not a populist. I've warned about populism many times on this show, explained it from the outset of Trump's candidacy when he rode down the escalator. And he's not the only example of that. There are many on both the left and the right that try to play the populist's game. So I do my best to call things as I see them, and I'm not here to represent anything other than my viewpoint. And that's always been the case. And I'm completely transparent about the work I do or the work I've done. And that's all I can do. So, you know, if somebody like Tom wants to, you know, kind of force feed Trump into this conversation as an I guess as an example of this larger problem of living in a post-truth era. And the post-truth era is an issue, and not calling things what they are is an issue. But I don't know. I suppose it just becomes tiresome when the never-Trumpers, like Tom, make alliance with people who don't exhibit any of the behaviors that I just described about myself, like the Lincoln Project, so many examples. not to mention the Joy Reids and the MSNBC propagandists. There's a source for the post-truth era, and the CNN propagandists and so many others. It's just monomaniacal about Trump, as if his sort of worst behavior is a cause rather than and the embrace of it is a cause rather than a symptom of what has been going on in this country for generations, as evinced in part by the data we just went over from the Wall Street Journal survey, looking at where we were on things that are important versus where we are today, with, you know, 25 years in between. I mean, to lay this all at any one person's doorstep is childish. It's not just inaccurate, it's childish. You don't belong at a table with serious people if you think this begins and ends with any one person. Just as it's childish and you don't belong at a table with serious people when you think you're going to pass a law and you're going to bring light, and that law will bring light into the pitch black darkness of somebody's soul who could execute an 8 or 9 year old kid. So I just don't indulge those sorts of delusions. I just describe them. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Good morning, Dan, Amy, and thanks for taking my call. I can't help but think of how many times over these past couple of years of all this illegal immigration that we've been told about all these little kids, and they've lost thousands and thousands of them. They don't know where they've gone, but they've gone somewhere with these gangs. The gangs are raping them. They're killing them. The kids are dying out there and everything like that. It's all because of this open border thing that these kids have become fair game for the games for making a lot of money off of these kids. And this damn administration, they're over here talking about guns and law-abiding citizens, but they don't care about gangs getting rich and destroying all these little kids that are of Spanish descent. Whatever the hell is going on with this regime, they're totally one-sided. For the criminal and crime, and they're actually against kids. They're not for kids. This guy is a Biden trying to act like he cares, but they don't care about kids at all. Everything they do is basically destructive to our kids.
All right, thanks for the call, Craig. Peggy, Chicago.
Hi. My heart is broken. You guys are more eloquent at stating this than I am. But this was a Christian school, private Christian school. Parents send their kids there so they'll be safe, so they'll have a childhood. And you think, well, they're safe, right? No, they're not. Evil comes to eat your lunch in the bag you brought it in, and somebody went in there. This is premeditated murder of innocent children. And not only that, but there are other people involved too. You know, you think you have a job, you're a custodian. I mean, who in the heck would come after you?
No.
You're an important person. You're important enough to slaughter. And what about seniors? These people were, head of the school was like 60 years old. You think you're safe?
61, 60. Yeah, and that custodian was family man, black man. Everybody said wonderful things about him, and then the substitute teacher, and then the principal of the school.
Mm-hmm. No one is safe, honey, and evil is out to eat your lunch in the bag you brought it in. They're coming to where you live, and they're coming for you. The time now is like, the only thing I can say, because I'm not as eloquent as you are, but I'm telling you, I'm so broken up. I don't know what to do. I really don't. I'm just sort of lost. But I heard something. You want to put a human face on this? People know these people, all right? There was a Mark Levin, and he had kids that knew these kids. And he was just almost, he was able to speak, but hardly able to speak. And he's pretty articulate, but he was lost. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, this is what's going to happen to each one of us. I hope you'll pick it up from here and just tell all the facts you know, because it was premeditated murder.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Peggy. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Let's talk about school board races. It's a week from Election Day. And as we've been intermittently talking about for the last several weeks, a lot of competitive school board races around Chicago Metro. And I told you we'd post some rundowns of the candidates and some identification, R versus D, even though these are nonpartisan. They're not actually nonpartisan. In addition to soliciting you for candidates you want to profile in districts that are important to you, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. I tweeted out the North Shore one yesterday. I've got Northwest Cook and West Cook coming, and DuPage right behind that, and then we'll round out the collar counties and get to at least some of the exurban counties as well. But this is against a backdrop where House Republicans just unveiled their parental rights parental bill of rights legislation last week. You've got 32 states that have some sort of parental rights legislation that has been presented. Trump in Waco over the weekend made the point of taking up K through 12 education in terms of what he promises to do if he is elected president again.
I will immediately sign a new executive order to cut federal funding for any school pushing critical race theory, transgender insanity, and other racial, sexual, or political content on our children. I will fight for parents' rights, including universal school choice and the direct election of school principals by the parents. If any principal is not getting the job done, the parents should be able to vote to fire and select someone else who will get the job done. We will defeat the cult of gender ideology to reassert that God created two genders, male and female. Thank you.
Some of the other stuff is things that you've heard. The reference to being able to fire a principal if the school is not performing, people may not be as familiar with that measure, but it actually has precedence. It's not something Trump came up with, because it may sound like, oh my gosh, you know what, the parents, you know, this argument about let educators do the educating because, you know, they've been trained and educated to be teachers and so on and so forth. And parents, of course, should have input, but, you know, you're just a stakeholder, as by the big guy, Secretary of Education, famously said, you're just a stakeholder in your child's education. Well, the parental trigger law, like what Trump is talking about, is actually in effect in L.A., and it's mainly for the benefit of minority parents when the local, I mean, this is part of sort of the under the umbrella of school choice, for parents in minority neighborhoods where the local school is not performing up to par, and it gives them the ability to come in and force a personnel change at the top to have some accountability to the community that you're hired to serve. So I just, people might hear that and be like, oh my, what, your parents deciding who the principal is? Not exactly. It's an accountability mechanism that provides some oversight for performance. And I like it. So that was Trump's rundown. And many others are jumping on board. Let's talk a little bit about specific school districts, just so since we have them. You know, West Cook is a Dem-dominated territory. Well, most of Chicagoland is Dem-dominated territory. And we could say the same thing about DuPage these days. Of the 13 school boards where there are competitive races in West Suburban Cook, 11 have Dem majorities, 11 of 13. There are 78 candidates running for 48 open seats across nine districts, 53 Democrats versus 19 Republicans when it comes to candidates for open seats. But there are some important ones. I go back to Lyons Township for two reasons, because there's been two incidents, one rather unique, the other not unique, but should be pointed out nonetheless because it should inform people's vote in Lyons Township. The rather unique is the Heaven Washington beatdown of a girl in the hallway at LT, and nobody seems to know whatever happened, right, in terms of the discipline, the disciplinary response, and potentially even law enforcement response to what we all saw, because Heaven Washington's friend videoed it for us. Still waiting to get some transparency. I know that's a favorite watchword. Well, transparency about what happened there.
We could call the victim's attorney. We know him. We had him on the show. I just get a follow-up and ask him. Yeah, that crickets from everybody on that one.
Right.
Because she was an activist in her school, BLM, you know, she was all in.
The other thing at 204 is imperiousness during COVID. Again, not unique, but should be pointed out. Carrie Dillon is an incumbent there. She is a COVIDian. She is a dyed-in-the-wool mask mandator. She also is somebody who ended a school board meeting last year when opponents to mandatory masking expressed their opposition. Do not interrupt me. This is not helpful. She essentially said that comments directed at the board could not be critical of the board. over at LT, they only accept compliments. Okay? So you could speak, but we only take compliments here.
That's ridiculous. North Korea does.
And so, LT is the school board, 7-0 Democrat. 7-0 Democrat. But you have three, Republicans running. But I want to say something about this, too. There's some pushback from Republicans, like, I'm not a Republican. Well, there's some, you know, Republicans by their voting record on school boards that are, I agree with you, you're not a Republican. You're a Democrat. You're a leftist, because they have completely thrown in with the agenda and the personnel choices of the left. So just because they have an R next to the name in the stories I'm posting doesn't necessarily mean they're helpful or they should be reelected or elected, because they've demonstrated that they're not an agent for change or accountability in these school districts that are performing so woefully, as we've discussed with the Wire Points data. And we'll talk more about that with Ted Dabrowski at the bottom of the 7 o'clock hour. on the WirePoints data on reading and math proficiency. But and the other thing too about actual like conservative reformers, the sane people who want schools to be focused on equipping children with the skills they need for success. The idea, because you're in a Dem district, that you're going to fly under the radar. Nobody can know I'm a Republican. I'm going to run a stealth campaign. No, you're not. No, you're not. That's not how it works, especially in low turnout races like school boards. Stop doing that. Stop trying to be too cute by half. Stop with the double bank shots. Here's what you do if you're one of these reform candidates, if you believe in schools fulfilling their core mission, not being used as incubators for leftist political activism. Here's what you do. You say so. And you communicate it such that people who are also sane, who live in your district, even if they're not a majority, come out to vote. Your candidacy is not supposed to be a secret. That's not how it works. And by the way, the left gets to play too, and they've got Pritzker money, and they've got websites set up, and they're identifying anybody who's not them as a right-wing extremist. So join the fight. I don't know what they're talking about, and I'm not anything. I'm whatever you want me to be. I'm a no-labels person. Just own who you are and make the arguments for your candidacy. That's how you get your people to turn out, and that's how you win the race in a district where perhaps you have a disadvantage in terms of the partisan distribution. I'm just hearing some of this. Oh, my God, don't identify me as this. Hey, be who you are and turn your people out. That's how you win low turnout races. This is a base plus exercise, not a hide from public scrutiny exercise. Okay? All right. So in Lyons Township 204,
yes,
you've got three candidates. Vilcek, Herndon, and Evans. And they're identified as such in this Wes Cook story that I'll tweet out. Vilcek, Herndon, Evans in 204. LaGrange, 102. Again, 7-0 Democrat. There's a Republican that's running. I'm not comfortable recommending her because I don't know yet. So this is what I mean. So
should she reach out to you?
Well, I mean, her name is Teresa O'Sullivan. Somebody who knows her, who we know is a conservative, or she wants to call in and make her case. But if this is my point about just the R versus D, that's just sort of that's the first threshold.
Right.
And then the second threshold is this somebody who is going to be an agent for change? Is this somebody who's going to stand up to the destruction of K-12 education that is occurring at the hands of the Democrats who dominate most of these school boards?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. No cough button. Sorry about that.
Dan and Joliet, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, Dan, do you have any info on any school board members running in Joliet? I don't know. I don't want to vote willy-nilly for these people.
I don't have Joliet yet, but thanks for the call. Sorry about that. But Will County is coming, so we will circle back on Joliet. Again, it's important to look at these because I just think people would be surprised. We started talking about it a bit yesterday at the distribution of Dems versus Republicans in places that I think some people still think are competitive, and they're not competitive, D versus R, but in low turnout elections where people don't know the names, that motivated minority can win the day. And this is essentially what we're arguing here. A couple more, but going in Northwest Cook, just to sprinkle the infield, and then if you have calls specific districts, we can address those as well, best as we have information at this point. But Palatine, Schaumburg, 211, that's a big district. There are candidates running that you should support. Kramer, Sam, Velez, and Dombrowski. So that you got four there. Control of the board, potentially. Arlington 214, that's the other one I wanted to get to. Arlington Heights 214, a lot of people have asked about that.
That's Hersey High School.
Yeah.
And others, yeah.
Right. And so here again, you have four Republicans running. And the only one I can recommend is Elizabeth Bauer. Bill Dussling, Alva Kreutzer, and Misa Edwardson. I don't know. And again, it's up to the candidates to make themselves known and to make it known to people. First of all, their constituents, and if they want amplification, us, who they are and what they are running on and what they intend to do if elected.
Bauer has signs a lot of signs up in Arlington Heights.
Right. She's Jane the Actuary.
Right.
Yeah. And she does great work on, I mean, this is, again, these backstory, these are the people that have work product that should impress you. She writes at, I mean, she tweets, but she writes for Forbes. She's a contributor to Forbes. She writes a lot about public sector pensions. She's very knowledgeable, and it's good stuff. And she gets the Ponzi schemes that they are. All right. Well, we'll post. Here, hold on a second. Michael Lewandowski, Lockport.
Michael? Hey, Michael, you there?
Hello, Michael.
Michael.
Hello?
Yep, you're on. Michael. 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 I think Michael Lewandowski running for District 205. Let's try that again one last time. No? Yes? No? Hello? No. Okay. Well, we tried.
Maybe no. Maybe now, Dan. I think we should give him one more try.
Is it our phones or is it his phone?
Well, we
is
got a lot going on right here.
Why is it always the other guy?
They're from the Republican Party.
Oh,
for
Michael.
A very long time.
Wait, hold on, Michael. We caught you. Michael, we caught you.
I've been listening to you guys every morning.
Really
enjoy it.
Can you hear me or no? Michael? Honestly.
Michael, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Oh, hi, okay. Michael. Okay, start from the beginning. Go.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I don't know what happened there. I'm Michael Lewandowski. I'm running for Lockport Township District 205. I've been precinct captain Lockport 5 for many, many years. Of course, I listen to you every single morning. I listen to WIND all day. I first heard Dan Proft on Don Wade and Roma's show when he used to call him his movie review. I've been on serving on the board since 1999, and I'm like the steady wheel trying to keep this thing from going off the rails over there. Even though I'm only one vote, I do make my voice be clear. I am a conservative. They know I'm not going to play around with any of their crap. And I was able to defeat DRT. However, DEI gets slipped through the crack. And it's unfortunate because those people are just so misled. Anyway, do you have any questions?
No.
Are you running with a slate of candidates or?
No, there's a group out in Homer that has three candidates running for three seats. There is one board member who's retiring and two incumbents. So I'm one of the incumbents.
All right. Michael Lewandowski, Lockport 205. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. By the way, Joliet, somebody that I trust, has texted in. The only one she would recommend is Damon. I'm going to.
You're going to pull on Amy J right now.
Damon Dunich. It's Z-D-U-N-I-C-H. Damon Dunich.
Dunich.
I'm pronouncing it. But Damon is the only Damon on the ballot for the high school district in Joliet. And that's a recommendation I can trust.
Okay, that's good.
Vince in St. Charles, you're in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, guys. What about St. Charles 303?
Yep, I got that. Thanks for the call,
Vince. They were very active during the lockdowns and mask mandates.
I do have a 303 slate here. I feel like I'm at the Redhead Piano Bar, people calling out songs. Wait, I know that song. Okay, does it go a little something like this?
Do I have the sheet music?
One second. Where the heck is 303?
I could talk about something.
All right. You could talk about something while I look up 303. Let's just do some vamping.
Vamping?
Yeah. All right. Sue and Glen Ellen, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, guys. Good morning. Glen Ellen, 89.
Yes. Oh, you're asking.
Yes. Who do you recommend?
I also have Glen Ellen, 89. Hold on. All right. Thanks for the call, Sue. I will get you 89. Glen Ellen, 89. Kevin McGrane, Juan Peralta, Scott Walkbusser. All right. McGrane, Peralta, Walkbusser in 89. Glen Ellen Elementary, District 41, while we're on the topic. Allison Prochaska. 303, got it here. Just 303, that's St. Charles, right? 303? That's
yep.
Who was at.
Yes.
That's what Vince was asking about. Lackner, Kuchert, Van Heel, and Tom Lentz for the 2-year. So Lentz for the 2-year, Van Heel, Kuchert, Lackner. Tim in Woodstock.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Amy. Hey, Dan, I was just wondering if you have any information on Gina Willard. Who, if I have it right, there's 3 incumbents running, and she's the only challenger. She's a Republican. But I can't even figure out a way to contact her or get a yard sign. But just wondering if you have anything on her.
This is for which district?
District 200. I'm sorry, Woodstock District 200.
Oh, I don't have Woodstock. All right, I got to get back to you on that. Sorry, Tim.
Sure.
Thanks for the call. Put it on my list. District 181, Clarendon Hills. Do we have that? Wait. Hold on a second. All right. Hold on.
There we go. Justin Kosick's back, everybody.
I'm thinking. What is...
Boom.
You need to consolidate these school districts. Let's just have one.
We have way too many
school
districts. I mean, yeah. Seriously.
Why don't
how
we
many
just run
there?
It like run it like CPS? No, I'm kidding, obviously. While we're on Glen Ellen, let me
You're
talk
out of
about
time.
Yes. Glenbard 87. Do we have candidates there? Yeah, we do. Glenbard District 87, so that's in the same. Gendress for the 2-year. And then we have Wilharm and Breed. Wilharm and Breed for the 4-year and Gendress for the 2-year. That's Glenbard. Michael and Wheaton here on Chicago's Morning Answer. Michael.
Yes.
Yep,
oh, I'm
on.
Sorry. I was hoping you would mention Wheaton.
Yes, I was hoping I would, too. All right, thanks for the call, Michael. Wheaton, I do have Wheaton.
Yeah, they're the ones that the Tribune deemed conservatives trying to take over your school board, as if it's some nasty, sinister thing.
Imagine conservatives
I mean, Trump-like MAGA people.
Well, imagine a conservative running for office in Wheaton. Have you ever heard of such a thing?
Oh, my God, the horror. Oh, my God.
The problem is, it is a surprise when you have conservatives in Wheaton now.
Right.
That's
They're an
commentary.
Anomaly. Yes, we understand.
District 200, Wheaton. Kim Hobbs for the 2-year. Amy Erkenswick, Garrett Spencer, Somer, and Dave Somer. So Somer, Spencer, Erkenswick, and Hobbs for the 2-year.
Okay.
Gina Westmont.
Hey, Dan and Amy. This is Gina Pirelli from Westmont, Illinois. I just want to say I'm the only conservative running for the library board. There's, I think, 6 seats open. So it'll be a battle for me, but I wanted to give a shout out also to the three candidates for our school board, District 201, which is Whitney Rogers, George Wilson, and I'm going to botch Jim's name, but it's Jim Lasiga.
Okay. All right. We'll sound it out at the ballot.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer.
Because they got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So earlier in the program, we mentioned the Wall Street Journal University of Chicago survey that finds a decline in people's ability to, or desire, really, to tolerate others. 80% of people surveyed 4 years ago thought tolerating dissenting viewpoints was important. That's down to 58%. Stephen Shaviro is not in the 58%. Stephen Shaviro is some sort of English teacher at Wayne State University.
Oh, in D-Town.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I've been there.
And
singing the theme song.
He wrote recently that, posted on social media, that incident that happened at Stanford, where the kid shouted down that federal appellate court judge, wouldn't let him talk, and then the die associate dean came in and held the, cuddled those kids that couldn't hear dissenting views on constitutional law. You know, future lawyers with a Stanford degree. Remember that thing that happened?
Oh, I remember, yeah. And the DAI director got reprimanded.
Yeah. Stephen Shaviro said the kid should have just murdered that judge instead. Although I'm reading from his post, although I do not advocate violating federal and state criminal codes, okay, I think it's far more admirable to kill a racist, homophobic or transphobic speaker than it is to shout them down. I don't advocate violating federal and state criminal codes, but I do advocate killing people. Yeah.
I don't know. What do you do with those homicidal tendencies there?
When right-wing groups invite such speakers to campus, it's precisely because they want to provoke an incident that discredits the left and gives more publicity and validation to these reprehensible views than they could otherwise attain. The protesters get blamed instead of the bigoted speaker. The university administration finds a perfect excuse to side publicly with the racists or phobes. That's a new one. You don't even have to go through homophobe, transphobe. Just phobes. You're phobes, a phobe.
Okay.
So the protesters get blamed instead of the bigoted speaker. The university administration finds a perfect excuse to side publicly with the racists or phobes. The national and international press has a field day saying that bigots are the ones being oppressed rather than the people those bigots actually hate being the victims of oppression. In short, every time protesters shout down a racist or transphobic speaker, they're indulging their own moral sense of validity at the expense of actually strengthening the very bigots whom they are protesting. Yeah, I know it's a lot to follow there. But anyway, the exemplary historical figure in this regard is Schwarzbard, who assassinated the anti-Semitic butcher Simon Petliura rather than trying to shout him down. So it's vigilante justice being advocated by this professor against people who've done nothing other than have an opposing viewpoint on a particular issue. Yeah.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Yeah. So that you want to get an understanding of where these kids at Stanford come from and how they're at Stanford despite their immaturity. Well, they've been educated, in quotation marks, for the first 20 years of their life by people like this Wayne State professor at the K through 12 level, who never matured and never will. He's been suspended for that post. Wow. Wonderful. The flip side of this is this very interesting piece by Mary Eberstadt. We've had her on the show. "You can't cancel me, I quit. I was supposed to be at Furman University. I decided to beg off rather than indulge an angry mob." It's better than saying that I decided to advocate for killing all the kids, which is, I guess, would be the flip side of our friend there at Wayne State University. No. "I was scheduled to give a speech at Furman about my recent book, Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. I canceled. Here's why. In the spring of 2014, the dress rehearsal for cancel culture, some convention speakers around the country were disinvited or withdrew themselves from consideration owing to left-wing protests. I wasn't among them. A few faculty members at Seton Hall tried to have my invitation rescinded on the grounds that I wasn't what they meant by Catholic," meaning she wasn't a leftist. "They failed. I delivered my address as scheduled in the Meadowlands to some 6,000 graduates and was awarded an honorary doctorate in humane letters. It was a thrilling event. I enjoyed talking to students," because she teaches, and she founded an organization that mentors women in journalism and media. "Those experiences probably explain why I never had been the object of protest by students. But 2023 is light years from 2014. Some months ago, the head of Furman's Tocqueville program invited me to give a public lecture about her book. And so she didn't know much about it. She Googled Furman. It's in Greenville, South Carolina, founded by the Southern Baptists. Seemed to be a promising opportunity to visit an attractive campus, befriend some students, faculty, talk over ideas. What could go wrong? Well, consider what happened to the speaker who preceded me last month in the same series, Scott Yenor. We've also had on the show. He's a poli-sci professor at Boise State. He had been invited to speak on Dostoevsky and conscience. Doesn't seem like that would be a triggering offering, but it was. Not that topic, but this speaker, Professor Yenor, because he had he's also written about feminism and his opposition to sort of modern day identitarian feminism. "Three armed policemen were assigned to his protection. Within the auditorium, protesters lined the walls the professor had to pass, holding posters with ad hominem slogans and quotations of his, mostly taken out of context. I called Professor Yenor to ask for his take. He said to Ms. Eberstadt, 'Never in my life have I experienced a crowd so uninterested in learning and so unwilling to hear. They were simply filled with malice.' No one in the administration commented on his treatment, much less apologized for it." I guess maybe if it had been videoed by somebody, it could have gone viral like the Stanford Law video. But regardless, that's an interesting observation, and it speaks to the survey data, and it speaks to the sort of ridiculous statements made by professors across the country, like that buffoon at Wayne State. "Never in my life have I experienced a crowd so uninterested in learning, so unwilling to hear. They're simply filled with malice." And so the upshot is, thinking about this and thinking about other incidents that have happened, we may have forgotten, but a Middlebury College professor attacked after she hosted a talk by Charles Thomas at Middlebury in Vermont. Remember that? She basically said what the headline indicates, that look, it's just not worth it. Subject yourself to what Professor Yenor described, people that are unwilling to listen and uninterested in learning, just filled with malice. Well, what point is that, to sit there and just be shouted at? I mean, I guess it gives you an opportunity for a viral moment if that's what you seek, but Ms. Eberstadt doesn't seek that. She writes, the students revulsed by free speech these days aren't victims, but poster children for the societal upheaval since the 60s that led to compound fractures on generations and the implosion of family, real-life community, and religion. It's also weakened many people's sense of identity, also borne out in those survey results. The rise in mental and emotional problems increasingly visible on campuses and on the streets today is a result. Mental and emotional problems, sure. They're manifest and very public. They are the poster children for those problems. Well, let's bring it home. Columbia College. Minority students don't feel safe at Columbia.
Editorial. Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Tell us why.
Nearly 70% of the freshmen who did not return after the fall 2022 semester were students of color. The school is brainstorming potential causes and solutions to retain students of color. This is the Columbia Chronicle. These are like future wannabe broadcasters, journalists, right?
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that what Columbia College is supposedly known for?
Yeah. Al Parker was a professor there back in the day.
So what's the cause? Why 70% of freshmen didn't return? 70% of the freshmen who did not return were students of color. What's the cause of that? Simple. Columbia is overwhelmingly white. And minority students do not feel comfortable, represented, or heard.
The real
issue is we have a predominantly white institution with an overwhelmingly white faculty. White professors cannot relate to students of color they teach, and many carry their implicit biases into the classroom filled with white students. Mm-hmm. Students of color, these are just generic statements that are unattributed, and there's no data to back them up, but it doesn't matter. This is how you're taught to reason these days. Students of color report not feeling heard in the classroom and often note the cultural differences between themselves and professors as a major contribution to that division. It's just a statement. It's just offered as a fact without any basis for it. But okay, sure. So whiteness is the problem at Columbia. Minority student, that's why 70% of the students not returning after their freshman year were students of color. The EdStats outfit that tracks this stuff, Columbia College 6-year graduation rate is 65% for Asians, 57% for whites, 41% for Hispanics, and 38% for blacks. 6-year graduation rate. Because students of color do not feel heard. Because it's all white. Graduation rate 65% for Asians, 57% for whites, 41% Hispanics, 38% black. Interesting. Yeah. Something else. This back from 2019, 3 years ago, 4 years ago now. More than 10,000 of the 16,000 black students enrolled in one of Illinois' 11 state subsidized four-year universities will flunk out of school. 6 in 10 black students are failing out of Illinois' four-year university statewide. But in 2023, Columbia College, 70% of the non-returning students from fall of 2022, in fall of 2022, being students of color, that somehow is because Columbia is too white. And yet 4 years ago, these are just data. 60% of black students in four-year universities in the state of Illinois were failing out, did fail out. Over the 6-year period from 2011 to 2017, only 37.5% of black students enrolled in Illinois' four-year schools completed 4 years of coursework. And what did I say the six-year graduation rate was for blacks at Columbia College? 38%, just like what's going on in all the other universities taken collectively in the state of Illinois. So I don't know. I guess either all of the colleges and universities in Illinois are beset by whiteness that is making students of color feel uncomfortable and unheard, or there's something else going on. I'll leave you to think about that. Pat and Lombard, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, Dan. Amy, I pulled my daughter out of Columbia University when, on the second semester, the professor from the basically the civics class came in and introduced himself as the leader of the Illinois Communist Party, and there was no way to buy.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, there was no way to buy any of the books on campus, so the second class
had to be redistributed.
In, yeah. The bookstore from the Illinois Communist Party came in to sell books, and my daughter actually had to write a check to that. So then a kid who's from Romania stands up in the class and, and goes, "You have no idea what my grandparents went through. You have no idea what's going on here. I am never coming back here." And the kid stood up and walked out of the class and never came back that day.
Wow.
So these people sold us a bill of goods when you came in. And to be honest with you, we sent our child to a local community college after that, and she seemed to excel until I re-entered her into a Christian college after that. They're just, at all costs, these people at Columbia are way off to the left.
The Illinois Communist Party. Thanks for the call, Pat. Are you now, or have you ever been a member of the Illinois Communist Party? Yeah, I went to Columbia. Harry in Michigan.
Hey, good morning. Yes, I still have a student or a son that graduated Columbia. He's one of those that's looking for the $10,000 of debt relief because he got basically terrible counseling, a degree that is basically useless because of the competition that's out there. And as far as the African-American students, the commencement service, which was probably the best thing that I paid for on my contributions, was 70% African-American students that put on a fabulous commencement, one of the best I've ever seen. And if that's the best I can say about the school, wonderful, because otherwise it's pretty well useless these days. Get rid of it and don't go there. That gentleman that just called, good for him that he pulled his daughter. Good for him.
Thanks for the call, Harry. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. A note from our discussion about school board races last hour. So District 181, Clarendon Hills, it's four candidates for four. That's why it wasn't on my grid, because it's a fait accompli. Four candidates for four spots. That's it. Same thing in Downers Grove 58, for those of you who haven't seen your ballot yet, waiting to vote on Election Day, perhaps. And speaking of elections, on Tuesday, April 4th, a week from today, we're not the only ones with spring elections. Our friends north of the Cheddar Curtain in Wisconsin have an April 4th election, too. And they've got a big race up there, State Supreme Court, which we've touched on a bit. But it's a race that has potential national implications, at least with respect to national elections. And for more on those implications, pleased to be joined by former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, now the president and CEO of the Young Americas Foundation. Scott, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Good to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
So frame this race and the state Supreme Court race in Wisconsin and Daniel Kelly, effectively the Republican candidate in the race.
Yeah. Justice Kelly, I appointed years ago to the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
He is now making another bid. He served his term, and the unfortunate, to have been on the ballot in the spring of 2020 when there was still a heated debate for president on the Democrat side. Bernie Sanders literally stayed in the race about a week before he suspended his campaign just to get people to turn out, and that was enough to be the difference. He's now coming back when there isn't, obviously, a presidential race on the ballot. I said at the time, all he needed was one vote. When he first got in mind, I pointed him, he's like a Scalia. He's just a rock-solid judicial conservative who upholds the Constitution and the law itself, compared to, as I call her, No Jail Janet, someone who's tried and lost before to people who are currently now on the state Supreme Court and who currently serves on the circuit court in Milwaukee County. And the reason I call her No Jail Janet is this woman has consistently, doesn't belong on any court, let alone the highest court. She has consistently not sentenced people like child rapists to any time in prison, including someone who raped a minor who was his own cousin. So this is just someone I think anybody, not just conservatives, should be distraught about. And yet she's eyeing up for the Supreme Court. And it, as you mentioned, has larger implications because unlike any race we've ever seen in Wisconsin for the court at any level, she's actually telling people what her views on issues are before the court, whether it's redistricting, whether it's abortion, whether it's any number of other issues. There's now even flyers out saying she's going to affect climate change. These are not the things you run for the court for, but she is.
Well, the redistricting piece and how that could potentially impact the 2024 election. What's the nexus there that people should understand?
Yeah, in Wisconsin, there are now only two of the eight members of Congress are Democrats, not unlike other parts of the country. If you draw lines even close to fairly, the Democrat votes are routinely, and you know this in Illinois, just like we do in Wisconsin, the Democrat votes are routinely packed into large urban areas. And the only way to get more Democrats into congressional maps is if you take, and just the ultimate partisan gerrymandering, you take streams, you put voters, pack voters in the large urban areas, and you just do a small little sliver all the way out into the suburbs and rural areas. Historically, that's been knocked out in the courts because that's not fair, that's not right, it's not communities of interest, it distorts minority voting rights, things of that nature. She's made it clear she's going to throw the map out. And if you do that, there's at least one, two, maybe even as many as three seats that would be in contention that are currently held by Republicans. And in a tight 2024 election cycle, that could be the difference between whether Kevin McCarthy is the speaker or one of the radicals on the left is.
Yeah, no, so that's exactly it. That's understood. That's what I wanted to get to, because people around the country should be looking at it. And interestingly, a lot of people around the country are looking at it, and they're on the left, and they're raising unbelievable amounts of money for No Jail Janet, as you call her. I mean, I saw a video fundraising message from Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Yeah, for her. Hollywood, I mean, stars. Yep.
So, I mean, has Wisconsin ever seen this for a state Supreme Court race, all the money coming from Hollywood and around the country?
This is by far going to exceed the all-time record for spending on a state Supreme Court race. And that even includes 2011, when they were trying to go after then-Justice Dave Prosser to try and undo the work that we had done, which, by the way, has gone through both 12 federal and state cases and been upheld. She's talking about getting rid of that as well. But it's probably going to be the most expensive race for the state Supreme Court in the country. And it's because they not only want to undo the good work we've done. People say, oh, what about crime? They don't, you know, circuit court, the entry-level court's the one that deals with that. No, the state Supreme Court deals with directions for the state courts. So they could very well do things like get rid of cash bail, mandate early release, do all sorts of horrible things. And as was just mentioned, nationally, could undo redistricting. This is why the left, in fact, the Veeps, a little video she talked about protecting our rights as if it's anything for her in California. No, this is just, it all boils down to Wisconsin is a battleground state. It has been for decades.
It's a blue state that we temporarily made purple. And they not only want to win this race and use the courts to undo the things that we've done and mandate other things they want, they see this all as a precursor to 2024 and blocking a Republican, no matter who it is, from being elected president over Joe Biden. That's what this is all about in their mind. That's why the money's coming in not only from New York and California, but places all beyond outside of the Midwest.
Has George Soros donated any money to her campaign? No.
Oh, their efforts are full scale behind this. I mean, this is his kind of person. She was before a judge. She was a part of the DA's office in Milwaukee County. And remember, that's the DA's office that let this scum, the guy who drove his red SUV through the Waukesha Christmas parade because he was out on $500 cash bail. This is the kind of crap, not only here, but across the country, you get if you put these people in office.
Has there been any polling done? I mean, how is she doing compared
to
the other
actually,
candidates?
There's none by the campaigns because, of course, Kelly's campaign is, you know, is doing well for a traditional campaign, but nowhere near the kind of money she has. But the statewide Chamber of Commerce a week ago had it within 2 points, which is remarkable considering, I mean, we've never seen a disadvantage in money the way it is between her and Kelly. But I think the effectiveness of and internally, you know, people like your listeners who get this understand it, the redistricting, the things like Act 10, the reforms I did, all these other things are at stake. People get that. What has really been effective in Wisconsin, understandably so, amongst swing undecided voters, is when they hear about her lack of handing down any kind of prison time to people who've committed rape, essentially, against children. People have done other awful things. They just are disgusted. And as I've said, I don't think she belongs on any court, the least of which on the highest court in the state of Wisconsin. So we get that message out between now and next week. I think we can win. But, man, they're spending a lot of money.
Doesn't belong in any court or in a prosecutor's office to begin with either, it sounds like. And we're obviously very familiar with that in Cook County. So what she's doing and what the left is doing there, it seems to me, is the typical sort of misdirection away from public safety, which is a preeminent concern, to make this a referendum on abortion and other like niche leftist issues. You mentioned climate change, but a lot of focus on abortion, which is also drawing in all the left money.
Oh, it totally is. And even there, it's a total lie. I mean, the only thing the court would decide, literally would could decide in Wisconsin, is the difference between two laws, one that goes way back to the year after the state was founded, which prohibits abortion entirely, versus a law I signed, obviously, before Roe v. Wade was undone with the Dobbs decision. And that law prohibits an abortion after 20 weeks. So it's either a choice between those two. There's no way the court, even in its activist position, would even be in a position to make a decision about anything other than those two cases. So they're just outright lying to people when they imply, when someone like Julie Louise Dreyfus and others imply that this is about protecting, you know, abortion on demand until birth. That would not be before the court. It's a question of these two. But the fact that they're telling people, I mean, just think about this, whether you're conservative or not, just think about anybody running for any judicial position telling you what their beliefs are before they rule. That's not why you have a judiciary. The judiciary is about upholding the law, not making law. But sadly, that's not what they do on the left.
Not pushing your political agenda, that's for sure.
I wanted to turn to your job at present, in addition to helping out in Wisconsin, which you clearly are, but the Young Americas Foundation, your President Young Americas Foundation, Speakers Bureau that provides speakers to college groups to bring them in to expand the parameters of discussion ostensibly on college campuses. There's an interesting piece we were just talking about before you joined us in the Wall Street Journal by Mary Eberstadt, who's an author and educator, where she talked about, you can't cancel me because I'm not going. And she was talking about a speech she was invited to give a talk about her new book at Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina. She basically said, per the treatment she came to understand, that other speakers like her with a center-right perspective on cultural issues, per the treatment she saw them experience and what they had to say about their experience at Furman, she canceled the speech. I'm not even going to bother because another professor spoke there, said, I've never encountered a group of students so unwilling to learn and unwilling to listen. And so it's just not worth my time to be heckled and have to be surrounded by police and to be shouted down like we saw that federal appellate court judge, the treatment we saw him get at Stanford Law a couple of weeks ago. What about that? Are you getting more speakers like Eberstadt saying, you know what, Scott, I'd love to go talk there, but it's just not worth it?
Well, we get that kind of treatment all the time, thankfully, yeah. And I totally get where she's coming from, totally get it. But thankfully, our speakers are willing to go into the lion's den, and here's why. My estimate, Ben Shapiro and I have talked about this before, we think there's 15, maybe 20% tops of the students on most campuses are the radical, loudmouth, obnoxious ones that we see protesting, that pop up, that shout out, that try and shut people down, that tried, for example, in New York State to literally grab the mic out of the hands of Art Laffer. Art Laffer, who's one of the most nice, joyful, happy, you know, free enterprise warriors out there, but who's 81 and is like everybody's favorite grandpa kind of a guy. And even there they went after him. But thank goodness, Dr. Laffer, that didn't stop him from going elsewhere for us, whether it's Ben Shapiro, Katie Pavlich, Michael Knowles, Matt Walsh, you name it. We've got speakers. We don't do more than that, too. The Reagan Rants, the Reagan Boyd Holm, all right. These great conferences. But right. These speakers are willing to go out because we have to. And the good news is, if you go to campus or if you go to YAF TV on YouTube, where we put all these lectures up, and we see not thousands but millions of views. We just surpassed 1 million viewers. We're at 750 million views already this year on our social media at YAF.org. But the reason why it's so important is the curious kids, not the loudmouths, not the obnoxious ones, the ones who come because of the protests to see what's going on, they need to hear the truth. And I totally get where this author is coming from, but we're not going to back down. If you're under attack, Yef's got your back, and we're going to help bring good speakers to campus everywhere in the country, including in Chicago.
Do you think it's getting better? I mean, it's hard to see how it's getting better on
college campuses.
Oh, it's
worse. It's worse and worse.
Yeah.
I mean, these are talk about privilege. More often than not, these are white, rich, privileged kids who think that they can make up for whatever, you know, problems they think they have by showing the rest of the world through virtual signaling how obnoxious they can be and how unwilling they are to hear any views that aren't their radical views of the world, when that's just not life out there. And as Americans, not just in college, but everywhere, on social media, in the media, elsewhere in life, we've got to push back. We don't have to adopt their tactics. We don't have to be crazy and out of control, but we can't be intimidated. That's what they're trying to do. It's what they tried to do to, you know, this years ago in Wisconsin. They tried to intimidate me with 100,000 protests. And we said, no, we're going to do what's right. And we got to do the same thing and show that, model that for young people on campuses and even in high schools.
All right. Well, yeah, you're the perfect guy for that job, given what you experienced as governor, as you just described. Absolutely. Scott Walker, former Wisconsin governor, current president, CEO of Young America's Foundation. That's YAF.org, YAF.org, and YAF TV, YAF.TV. Scott, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good to be with you. Keep fighting for freedom.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Insert Democrat socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House floor for 30 plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. Gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. You're moving out.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. That theme music means it's time for our weekly conversation with Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, wirepoints.org, all things Illinois policy related. But before we get to him, I've got to say, One of the more entertaining comments I've seen in this mayoral race between P-Hat Paul and BLM Brandon happened yesterday when BLM Brandon spoke at the City Club.
Yeah.
City Club, that's a gathering where you have a family-style lunch with your fellow government employees or government contractors. That's the assembled audience there.
Right. Was it which part?
The part where he rejected this idea that he wants to defund police, but he went further than just rejecting it.
Now it's
Don't
racist.
Tell me that our safety comes down to a doggone hashtag. It's racist and it's ridiculous.
It's your hashtag.
Right. You started this. You
own
it. I mean,
he didn't start the whole thing, but I mean, it's your hashtag. You are part of the defund the police movement. That movement called itself defund police, and now it's racist.
Yeah, and also too, he wanted to selective enrollment. Don't you know? There's no equity. It's not fair, Dan.
The people of Chicago want a just and equitable system where no matter where you live in the city of Chicago, you have access to a fully funded neighborhood school. If you were to ask parents, they would say what I'm saying because I am a parent.
Yeah, I'm a parent too. Johnson hits people had to walk that back after his City Club appearance, saying a Johnson administration would not end selective enrollment at CPS. By creating high quality schools in every neighborhood, we would reduce the pressure on families and the selective enrollment process.
Yeah, okay. I mean, that's just sort of obscuring the actual position, which he offered very clearly. Of course, he's a Chicago Teachers Union apparatchik. He's against school choice.
He gets paid $100,000 a year. Doesn't have to report into an office anywhere. Nice gig.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. I mean, yeah, it's not that nice, but
he loves it.
Anyway, all right. For more on the mayor's race and some of these other races, particularly school board, Ted Dabrowski, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
I know you're not a Chicago resident, Ted, but from a policy perspective, is there anything that excites you about this mayor's race, depending on the outcome?
No, I'm, to be honest, I'm not that excited because I don't see the real vision of turning around Chicago, and that's a lot of people's dream is to see the Chicago that's this awesome city that it should be, and there's nothing in the policy prescriptions out there that try to change that. All it does is either kind of hold the line, you know, let's get back to the 2019 Chicago we had, which was, you know, already in deep trouble, or on a path which is, you know, much more dangerous, and that's one where, you know, we have more crime, our schools get worse, and people keep fleeing, and that's, you know, either way, I think that keeps happening. So you've got to have this massive change at some point, and as we've talked about, we're not ready for it yet. People aren't ready for it; they're not demanding it yet.
School board races. If you were providing advice and counsel to incoming school board members, let's say some of these reform-minded school board members win, and whether they're going to be going into boards where they're not in the majority, forget the RD, they're just not in the majority in terms of mindset and mission. And so what would you advise school board members, incoming school board members, to be focused upon, to think about, to watch out for?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot just in the data, and the data tells a lot. And you know, the other side doesn't care about the data. They're going to diminish the data. They're going to try to hide the data. But the more that it can come out, I mean, you know, I was looking at like this, you know, places like Oswego and well, even Springfield. I posted just a few minutes ago what's happening in Springfield. You know, the numbers are horrific, and it's hard for them to hide from. I'm going to give a story because I went down to Springfield last week, and I testified in front of the Education Appropriations Committee,
and I
threw these numbers out there. Well, you know,
sometimes, yeah.
I can tell you what. They don't give a damn. I mean, they don't give a damn about these numbers. And I shouldn't say they, because some of them do. That's how I got invited. There's a few people who do care, and you know, Blaine Willauer is one of them. But there's a whole bunch of people that don't care, and it's the soft bigotry of low expectations is in full force in that committee. You know, it's funny. I talk about third grade numbers and how critical it is for third graders to be able to read before they move on. And Mara Hirschauer, who's a state rep, you know, asked me how much time I spent in third grade classrooms and did I really know what I was talking, you know, effectively asking if I knew what I was talking about. But, you know, I brought back places like Decatur and Mount Vernon, all these places where most kids can't read. And then you look at a place like Springfield, their numbers are horrific as well. You know, you're talking about 2 out of 10, 3 out of 10 kids being able to read, and the others can't. So I think in these teacher evaluations, 100%, I think there's a lot of just pure straight data to raise a lot of questions and put the other guys on the defensive. It doesn't mean you're going to win, but you're going to win a lot of ears with let's call them center left concerned parents who maybe aren't on our side to start saying, what are these numbers? These are crazy numbers. What are they true? Are they correct? And slowly start to win over people, because that's what we need to do, is win them over.
Mara Hirschauer, she represents like West Chicago, South Elgin, Bartlett. How many third grade classrooms has she been in? And, you know, visiting a classroom to say, hi, I'm your state representative, doesn't give you exactly a handle on what's happening in terms of kids' reading and math aptitude, which is what you're talking about. And the school districts in her legislative district are terrible. I mean, with a capital T. So so it speaks to your point about sort of their indifference and dismissive attitude. I agree with you. I think that the idea that at minimum as a school board member, you need to you can relentlessly every single meeting demand information and make that information, which should all be public, minus personnel record stuff. Most of that should be public, and you make it public and you pore over it and you demand explanations of why our school district is, you know, under 50%. In terms of reading and math at grade level, which is most every school district in Chicagoland.
Yeah, you know, Springfield, you know, just two of every 10 kids can read at grade level, and just, well, whatever, 15 out of 100, 15%. And yet, you know, the spending per student is up 50% in the last decade. Student enrollment is down 22%. I mean, these stories are playing out everywhere. And I think it makes it really hard for you know, these school districts that think they're performing well to defend themselves. You know, what's fascinating, there's a guy on our side who called me after these report cards came out. And he's at one of these really, you know, what, 214, so that's, what is it, Arlington Heights and
yeah,
all that.
Percy, yeah, high school.
And he called me. Yeah, and he called me and he said, hey, your report card is wrong. It says 42% are reading at grade level. He says, that can't be right. My kid went there. He did great. It's a great school. 42%. It's got to be wrong. Well, I, you know, pulled up the report card, and there it was. Even he was shocked. Now, I got a letter from a lady who actually took the report card and went and spoke to her board. And I loved. She showed me the letter she sent. And she basically, after she read out the stats, she said she wanted in writing from the board these three questions. You know, she had three questions. She said, I want an answer in writing on these things. And I had to do around the proficiency levels and all that. And I thought that was fantastic, because she asked them to do something. Now, let's see if they actually answer, because, you know, they don't answer when you're standing there, right? You have to, but let's see if they answer in written form. And I like that, because she's putting pressure on them to respond to these things. And so I hope to put out her letter if she lets me. And I want to see what responses the board give, because they should give one.
I saw you were recently on Univision to talk about these same measures with respect to Latino students specifically. So what kind of reaction is that? So from Spanish media, number one, they're amplifying it, which is, that's good. But I just wanted to, like, what's the number? 18%, 20% reading and math proficiency statewide.
Yeah. And, you know, and 17% for, what is it? 18% for reading in Chicago. I don't know yet. We're gonna like check it out. What was fascinating to me is when we put out a press release that we did the report card. You know, we didn't hear from Chicago Tribune or, you know, yeah, any of those about the low scores. But what was really cool is that Enrique Rodriguez from Univision reached out and said, "Hey, I want to look at your thing." And if you watch the thing, of course, it's in Spanish. What's great is that he unpacks the whole report before I ever come on. He unpacks the report card. You know, and talks about, you know, the teacher, he kind of laughs about it. He says, look at these teacher evaluations compared to the reading results. Look at these, graduation rates, and he points it all out. And then, of course, he gave me a couple of minutes to talk about it. And I love that. You know, I don't know where the politics are over Univision, and you know, they're they were willing to point this out where the rest of the media is not. You know, the rest of the media is actually taking the opposite stance. But I was really happy that the Latinos like school choice. You know, they like Catholic schools by nature. They're not happy with a lot of what happens with a lot of the social issues we've been talking about on the transgender and the sex ed and the CRT. They don't like that stuff. They want, you know, it's hard, but they want a good quality education and they want good values for their kids. So I think it's promising. We're going to try to make big inroads into trying to reach the Hispanics, because they should know exactly what's going on in their schools and how the schools are failing. So,
well, who's going to get the Latino vote, Vallis or Johnson?
Oh, man, you know, that's another good question.
Vallis is going to get the Latino vote, but I mean, that's not going to be determinative. I mean, it's just not a big enough cohort.
Yeah, the problem is
it's not a big percentage of the undecideds either. It's not a big percentage of the undecideds.
Yeah, and they don't come out and vote enough. And they, you know, they of course have the fastest growing demographic, and you know, they're bigger now than the blacks in the city. But until they actually start coming out and voting in full, and until they realize their political power, then it doesn't matter yet as much.
Yeah, and until they stop electing socialist aldermen in some of the Latino wards, they're not going to realize the strength of their numbers either. I mean, good grief. It's just when we do these things by race, I mean, every single race is a mess in Chicago. White, black, Latino, it's a mess. We divide it that way because we're a racially polarized city. But, I mean, the way we talk about this stuff is just so ignorant. It just drives me loony, and that's a short trip. I wanted to get to something else your colleague wrote, Mark Glennon, because we've been talking so much about school board races, and thanks to your good work, we have some data that's hopefully waking some people up about the importance of figuring out what the heck is going on at their local school district, particularly in the suburbs. And when people start, you know, continue to get flyers in the mail and stuff, or caucus endorsed, really good piece about the local caucuses, this sort of anachronism that some communities still use to slate candidates. And, whoa, the village elders have come together and they've slated these candidates, so stick with the caucus. And it's in places like Hinsdale and Lake Forest and the North Shore. Talk to us about the caucus the caucus construct, and whether or not voters should take the recommendations of their local caucus where they exist.
Yeah, if you have no idea, you know, your caucus, you know, like I'll talk about the Dutrier caucus, right, and where I live. You know, these are all your good people from your neighborhood. You've seen them in the neighborhood. They're all professionals and all that. But when you dig deep, man, I tell you, this is a long-standing power. It's a club. It's really hard to get into the caucus. You know, it's the caucus that chooses the quote, approved slate from the caucus. And, you know, once they choose somebody for that slate, it's almost like a guaranteed way to win, because if you're not in that slate, oh my God, you weren't picked by the caucus. But when you peel back the onion, you start to see that the caucus really supports the status quo of what's going on. You know, they will take on anybody who challenges anything, whether it's the sex ed, whether it's the whole COVID mitigations, or hell, if you want to talk about academic excellence, you're probably deemed a redneck. You know, sorry, you can't be in the club. And so these caucuses have amassed this power. They have this aura of
authority.
They're the elders,
yeah,
like you said, authority. Yeah. Yeah. And it's just not true. It's false. And you know, they're blocking the reforms. And you know, what's crazy about that is Nutrier. You know, speaking of report cards, Nutrier had 88% reading proficiency in 2017. Right. So this is before COVID, 88% reading proficiency for the whole district, and it's dropped to 70%. So it's a pretty big drop. And you know, that should have a lot of people worried, because, you know, Nutrier is about, well, it was about academic excellence. Now it's, you know, now we talk about all kinds of other things except for academic excellence. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these slates are very, very powerful and dangerous, because they don't let other voices come in.
And people, 70% reading proficiency, reading at grade level at Nutrier. People listening to this that don't, you know, that probably not listening to, because our audience is informed, but people that didn't know anything about the things that we talk about, say, well, what do you think the reading proficiency, what percentage of nutrition students do you think read at grade level? You invariably, people would say 100%, 95%, 99%, yeah. Right? They have no idea. And by the way, 70% is like, oh, well, if they're at 70 and we're only at 55, then that's not so bad. We're pretty close to nutrition. Wait, let's remember the point. The point is 100%. The point is that no one should be graduating from high school or grade school if they're not proficient in reading and math at grade level. That's the point, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, think about it. 30% of kids at Nutrier can't read at grade level. I mean, that's phenomenal. And now then there's the big news about all the what do they call it? Truancy, right? All these maybe it's not the word truancy for Nutrier, but this absenteeism, it's gone crazy where kids aren't showing up for school anymore. So if they're not showing up for school because, well, you know, you got to, you know, whatever. I don't know what to call it. Then they can't read. You know, something has to change. And instead, we're going into that crazy path that, you know, academic excellence becomes a bad word.
He is Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, wirepoints.org, all things policy related. Thanks, Ted.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The Godfather has spoken. Talking about Rick Santelli, of course, the Tea Party Godfather. And this was his take the other day on the quote-unquote banking crisis.
Is this really a banking crisis? Joe, you know what it is. It's a Fed crisis. It's a rate hiking crisis. It's a crisis built on a crisis we never solved. And now we have walkbacks, takebacks, Treasury secretaries changing their mind. Is it any wonder there's all this volatility in the markets?
Crises upon crises. For more on all of them, pleased to be joined by John Tammany, editor of Real Clear Markets, director of the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks, and author of The Money Confusion, How Illiteracy About Currencies and Inflation Sets the Stage for the Crypto Revolution. John, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Is Rick right?
I think he overstates the Fed's role a bit. The Fed's a rate follower. How we know that in this case is that no one was able to predict where rates were going. And they couldn't because the markets, the future of markets is very opaque. We know that because if you can see around the corner in markets, you're worth many billions. And so the Fed did start raising rates, but access to money, it was already becoming more expensive in the actual marketplace. So I think he overstates the Fed's role.
Should the federal government have stepped in, the Treasury Department, and guaranteed the deposits of Silicon Valley depositors above 250 grand?
No, it didn't need to. Because if you look at Silicon Valley Bank's balance sheet, it was mostly treasuries. I mean, these were reasonably good assets for one thing. And so most of these depositors were going to be made whole in the first place. Secondly, if a bank runs into trouble, that's an opportunity for another bank to gain a lot of market share and goodwill with the clients by making depositors whole. So without the FDIC, this notion that SVB was just going to shut down and people were going to be banging on its windows trying to get their money out and never get it really doesn't make sense. It was the 16th largest bank for a reason. It had a great client list. Someone was going to come, and you didn't need the FDIC here.
So what happened then?
Well, this is what the FDIC does. What are government bureaucracies but bureaucracies in search of a purpose? And so it's certainly true in Silicon Valley. The VCs had tightened up on their startups, and in tightening up, it forced the startups to more aggressively withdraw capital from the bank. It's certainly true that that SVB's asset mix was a little bit long, and so when market rates are going up, the value of your balance sheet's going to go down. And so amid all this, it looked a little bit touchy for SVB to make all of its people taking money out whole. But even there, you wonder, the question I keep asking is, why did Peter Thiel yell fire? Because this was not some bank taking enormous risks. Again, this was just a bunch of treasuries on its books, which there are a lot of things, but they're not unsafe. Markets trust them. Why did Peter Thiel yell fire and say, go get your money out? I still don't understand that, and I think that's the answer.
Does he have a position at First Citizens? I have no idea either. Maybe he just had a different perspective on the viability of the bank. I don't know. Thiel's a smart guy.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because he kept his money in there. He had about $50 million in SVB, and he didn't withdraw his. Huh. And so it would be one thing if SVB had made all these crazy, crazy loans that impaired its balance sheet. But see, banks as a rule can't do that. And they can't do that because one bad loan erases 99 good ones. The business model is to be conservative. And SVB was very conservative. And it still runs odd that there'd be a run on a bank that had reasonably very safe stuff and why Peter Thiel became alarmed. But for now, we don't know.
So what about this deal, since I mentioned it, with the First Citizens and FDIC? They're going to be in bed together with this acquisition of Silicon Valley Bank. So here we have First Citizens, which now is on the cusp of being too big to fail with this acquisition. And they're doing a loss share agreement with FDIC. By the way, all the other banks and by extension their customers are getting hit with $20 billion in the FDIC bailout, which is more than all that the FDIC paid out for all bank failures in the last decade.
Well, the first thing is implicit in the FDIC getting in bed with First Citizens is that to make the purchase, it's going to have to make depositors whole. So it's not as though taxpayers are going to be out $20 billion. But this isn't me defending the FDIC. I think without it, you'd very quickly see insurance companies come in and insure deposits at banks for a monthly fee. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a bit of an overstatement there, but I do think we have a creeping fascism in banking that has existed for a long time. We are in the process of nationalizing banks. Let's be honest about what this is. Banks, because government's so in bed with them, because quite literally there are hundreds of regulators inside banks at all times from the government watching over them. Banks are a nationalized, describe fascism what it is. It's private ownership, government control. This is what we have with the banking system increasing.
They're like utilities. And do you trace that back to 08, 09 and was that when we reached or we passed the point of no return with the bailout of Bear and Goldman, but not Lehman? No?
No, we were already there. I mean, it's so easy to forget, and that's why the explanations of SVB have been so poor, including from our side, regulatory failure. Oh, please. If you could see that SVB had problems, you could, and if you were if you could see into the future, as we expect regulators to do, you'd be worth billions. You wouldn't be a regulator. And so you look back to 2008, Citigroup, which had been bailed out five times, the fifth time was in 2008. It had over 60 full-time federal regulators in the headquarters. It was already a fascistic enterprise, a lot of risks. I hate to say it, but when you direct a lot of money toward home loans, that's a sign that you're going conservative. Banks historically hadn't done housing. And so it was all there. It's just becoming more so. As you allude, every bank is going to be viewed that if a bank fails, it would cause Great Depression or worse. That's just ludicrous. But that's what's believed. And so banks are at this point, they are basically a supplicant of government. Well, let's be honest. That's what they are.
All right,
so
John.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to change topics, so if you have an on topic.
Well, I mean, just one more question on banking then. So with that that deepening relationship or deepening control, relationship is too euphemistic, deepening control of banking by government, then what happens to these smaller banks around the country that are not too big to fail, that don't have political sway?
Probably more and more of them are swallowed. Some will survive because they've got niche businesses and they will pay more for access to capital because they're not protected by government. What you'll see more broadly is that banking will become even more vanilla. My guess is lots of low rates, banks taking no risk, whereas the real risk in finance will occur well outside of the actual banking system. There's this assumption that if government just gets in and controls the banks, that will somehow make finance safe. No. Finance is supposed to be unsafe. I've told you before, my first day at Goldman Sachs, the first thing they showed us was, here's a deal tombstone from the 1950s. How many of these entities are still with us? And the point was, don't mess around. Your mistake could take us down. We are in an ephemeral business. And so we're going to see more and more of that move away from banking. Banking will be more and more, as you allude, a utility taking no risks. And because it takes no risk, it will be less and less relevant. This is what I've been arguing for a while. There's a reason the Fed isn't very consequential. It projects its influence through entities that really aren't a player in the real economy. That's going to go even worse with what you describe, as in government basically insuring every bank deposit.
All right, John Tamney, you wrote a string of articles about TikTok at realclearmarkets.com. So why?
Oh, you're going to get me on this.
Well, why is TikTok is embarrassing and un-American with what we're trying to do?
Well, it's embarrassing and un-American because I think we were all around when the Soviet Union existed. Were politicians beating up Soviet businesses because they thought they were gathering information on them for the communists? No, they weren't, because communist countries don't produce any businesses that anyone wants anything to do with. The fact that TikTok is so successful is all the evidence you need that China's many things, it's no longer communist. If it's about gathering information, you could get that information with or without the existence of TikTok just by going to brokers on the internet who can provide all of that. This is a non-story. TikTok's problem is it's been too successful. It's beating the hell out of a lot of successful U.S. companies. And so protectionist politicians are coming in to try to break what's successful. I find it horrifying, and it's un-American because we used to want China to not be communist. Now that they're not, now that they're producing to meet our needs, now that we're working more and more together, we're trying to break them and break their achievements. I find it horrifying.
Well, I mean, there's a certain lack of forthrightness from the TikTok CEO that was on display at the hearing last week. But the other problem I have, why I'm not on board with the TikTok ban either, is, you know, especially this administration and the relationship that the Biden family clearly has to the Chinese communists financial. But even if it wasn't the Biden family, it's just I don't want the government getting deeper into regulating content online. I mean, there's no way that ends well, right?
You agree with AOC?
Yeah, I mean, AOC, as usual, full agreement. Yeah.
Yeah. Why is it that government always has to win? Why is it that its power always has to grow?
Well, and why do we believe that the government, this same government that we're critical of in almost every respect as free market types, as conservatives, including now law enforcement, for goodness sakes, but we're going to trust them to protect us here?
Yes.
I don't get it.
And they base it on, well, you know, social media is dangerous. For one, you know, there was a reason that many on our side wanted to abolish the CIA. And the reason was this vastly well-funded entity had no clue. They didn't know. They thought it was a large economy. Yet we're supposed to believe the Chinese, because they're Chinese, I guess, looking out online and gain voluminous intelligence that will allow them to trick us into what? But you see, anyone who's ever been to China knows the Chinese people are conducting a passionate love affair with all things American. As I've said so many times on this show, everywhere you look is an American business there. So the Chinese people love us, but our political class thinks an app is going to convince Americans to not love the greatest country on earth. What, this is the insulting aspect of it. Wow, you think so little of the United States and so little of the American people that they would be fooled by a bunch of flunkies and Chinese intelligence? I mean, what's happened to us? This victimhood from the political class and this victimhood from conservatives, I find just revolting. And I'll add, notice, Google your favorite libertarian thinkers on the matter of the economy and then do it in concert with TikTok. Notice how many have taken a powder on this debate. They know what's happening to TikTok is horrifying, but they don't have the courage to defend it. They're just being quiet about it. And these would be many famous names, including the most important editorial page in the United States, is sitting out this debate altogether.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to me there's a certain sort of, this is a way to cover ourselves politically with our business interests in China, perhaps our relationships with the Chinese Communist Party, because it's hard to have business interests there if you don't have a relationship with the Communist Party. So this is what we'll throw them TikTok as a way to get people off the scent of other such issues.
Yeah, I think you're right, but it's kind of like, so Fox is in trouble for paying for basically saying, well, the elections might have been stolen, and feeding their viewers that viewpoint. Agree or disagree, that's not my purpose. I don't have an opinion there. But with TikTok, we have most of conservative media just avoiding the discussion altogether. And I find that embarrassing because they know what's going on here, but they don't want to offend their readers. They don't want to offend their watchers. They're just going to play dumb and act like this isn't happening.
He is John Tammany, editor of Real Clear Markets, director of the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks, author of The Money Confusion, How Illiteracy About Currencies and Inflation Sets the Stage for the Crypto Revolution. John, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Are you a user of digital blackface?
312-642-5600.
In other words, a racist.
I think you might have to start at the pedestrian level and explain what digital blackface is.
Okay, let me do that. Kimberly Wilkins. Remember Kimberly Wilkins? She was the black woman who escaped an apartment fire and offered a rather colorful description of what happened to a local news outlet. And her interview went viral. Here it is.
Well, I woke up to go get me a cold pop. And then I thought somebody was barbecuing. I said, oh, Lord Jesus, it's a fire. Then I ran out. I didn't grab no shoes or nothing, Jesus. I ran for my life. And then the smoke got me. I got bronchitis. Ain't nobody got time for that.
You know what I've just done?
You were digital.
No, I've committed audio blackface.
Oh.
If you post the video online.
You're racist.
Digital blackface.
It's digital blackface.
This.
There have been other things, too, where somebody saw a rapist in Alabama and he went viral, too, for his soundbite clip that he made. I mean, you know, I don't know.
So this right. So if you do that, or if you like Michael Jordan crying, or you know, some sassy remark from RuPaul to as you know, your comment on social media.
Or as a meme or something.
And you're a honky, then that's digital blackface and you're racist.
What's the punishment?
This think piece comes to us, well, where else? A combination of CNN and Teen Vogue, which are basically on par with one another. If you're black and you've shared such images online, you get a pass. But if you're white, you may have inadvertently perpetrated one of the most insidious forms of contemporary racism. Right. Of course, it's insidious because they're looking and inventing where none exists. Digital blackface, according to intellectual over at Teen Vogue, Lauren Michelle Jackson. She's over at Teen Vogue. She's described as a cultural critic. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. She's lived. She's got a lot of culture behind her.
Teen Vogue. Digital blackface, the practice where white people co-opt online expressions of black imagery, slang, catchphrases, or culture to convey comic relief or express emotions. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Jackson says, the cultural critic, says the internet thrives on white people laughing at exaggerated displays of blackness, reflecting a tendency among some to see black people as walking hyperbole. What about that white Pat-looking girl boy who screamed in learning that Trump was elected in 2016? What about that one? Is that an exaggerated hyperbole of a white Pat? Okay. Anyway, if you're not sure how to define digital blackface deeply, I mean more specifically than just my surface level definition there, the cultural critic, Miss Jackson, says it includes displays of emotion stereotyped as excessive. So happy, so sassy, so ghetto, so loud. Our dial is on 10 all the time. Rarely are black characters afforded subtle traits or feelings. We are your sass, your nonchalance, your fury, your delight, your annoyance, your happy dance, your diva, your shade, your yaz moment. The weight of reaction, gifing, period, rests on our shoulders, writes Jackson, the cultural critic. what is it in a modern context? According to critics like Ms. Jackson, it's a modern-day repackaging of minstrel shows, a racist form of entertainment, popular in the 19th century, of course. This is, and so now, because we've done that, we're like a modern-day Amos and Andy. So, do you do it? Like, if you, what about if you do, like, an emoji? What if you do a thumbs up and it's a black hand? Does that count? Jason Whitlock, podcaster, his podcast Fearless, very good. He was on with Tucker Carlson last night to react to this, and here's what he had to say.
So what you just said, there's just not enough racism, and so they're inventing new forms of racism. And the next thing CNN will be telling us is about digital lynching.
Yeah.
And digital lynching is when someone criticizes Barack Obama, Michelle Obama, or Stacey Abrams or Kamala Harris.
Dan,
and then
it.
They'll have digital slavery. And that'll be when Trump returns to Twitter and someone likes a Trump tweet. That's digital slavery.
Exactly.
And then there'll be systemic digital racism. And that will be, and that is when Elon Musk purchased Twitter and quit shadow banning conservatives. That's, you know, systemic digital racism. They got to come up with this stuff because they're hiding from the fact, they're trying to cover the fact that while anti-black racism has decreased in America and everybody can see it, anti-white racism has increased in America, and anybody that's not have their head in the sand buried can see that. And so they're just covering up the fact that anti-white racism is out of control. No, the president's doing it. Everybody over social media is doing it, and they want to hide from it by creating, this digital, you're doing digital blackface. It's a joke, Tucker. It's a scam.
It's a scam.
Scam.
That's perfect.
Yep.
It's a hustle because these are race hustlers. Of course it is.
Slavery.
Digital racism and then systemic digital racism.
Yeah,
I love that. Whitlock is a funny guy. Carl in Big Cabin, Oklahoma.
Oh, take us.
Good morning.
One of my favorite, I think it is Dave Chappelle, is the one where he's pointing at his head saying, think. And I have to apologize to all African Americans and any person of color at this point for thinking that a person of color could be smart.
Right. Thanks for the call, Carl. Using the Dave Chappelle meme, you know, as a, right. Yeah, I got it. The sarcasm, we get it. Pat, Southside. Hey, Pat.
Oh, hi. How are you guys? I was just going to say that it sort of blows my mind that all of these silly call-outs are just continuing to segregate us. I'm in my late 50s, and I thought we were over this. And many times when I was using Facebook, I would use little GIFs like Kenan Thompson, like, huh, or one of the guys from Key and Peele. It was just like the perfect face for the reaction to the stupid posts that I had seen. Right. And I just never thought of the person being black. It just didn't occur to me that I was in any way slandering or even noticing that they were black. I thought we got over that, you know, so it's just, to me, it's, we're going so far backward in this country. It's incredible.
They're digging deep, aren't they? Yeah, this is sort of like team mascots in the sense that, wait, like if I use a GIF of Eddie Murphy or whatever, that's a compliment. I'm using it because he's funny. And you know, he's a comedian. So
well,
that
comedians,
makes sense.
That's a danger zone now.
But so it's the same thing. Like mascots are slights. GIFs of somebody is a slight because they have an expression or they make a joke or they have a person. I mean, it's just and first of all, the level of boredom one is suffering from to have to invent these things, to think about where else does racism exists, where else, you know, where else and how else can I perpetuate the race hustle? And boy, oh boy, I mean, that, you know, you got
they're
some
digging deep right now.
Yeah, there's a combination, you know, between boredom and creativity, I guess.
Well, I'll say personally, you know, that I would not retweet or, well, I used to have a Twitter account. I don't have a Twitter account anymore, but I would never touch any of that. Like if I
never touch what?
Well, that the lady's comment that was going viral, you know, surviving the fire, and I just would not retweet that or use it as a meme or do anything with it, just because I think it's racially insensitive. For me personally, I just don't want to get.
So you believe in digital? You believe in digital blackface? That's a thing for you?
No, I don't know. I guess they've labeled it that. I just stay away from that. And also, as a reporter, you know, I would not ever interview somebody who had a pick in their hair or a woman who had rollers in her hair because no one's listening to what they're saying. They're focusing on, wow, that guy's got a big, you know, pick in his head or she's got big curlers. Like, I didn't partake in any of that because
no one was listening.
No one's listening to what they're saying. They're just focused on their
There's a guy in a suit at the news desk and a woman in a business suit or a dress next to him, and no one's listening to what they're saying either. I mean,
I'm just telling you what my personal protocol.
Because you're afraid.
No, because it was ridiculous and that was stupid. Like, put a shirt on. I'll interview you. You got to put a shirt on. I'll interview somebody in a bare chest.
She had a shirt on.
Yeah. It's still.
No, why don't you just admit it? You're afraid. It has nothing to do with whether you think it's had nothing to do
but
with
I was
believing that is racially insensitive.
Culture.
You're just afraid.
Before there was even cancel culture, I was afraid. I'm talking about something I did in the 90s when I lived in everywhere, Detroit, Tucson, El Paso. I just never, somebody looked strange. Or I just was, anything that would take away from what they were saying, I would ask them to.
Oh, really? So you wouldn't interview Malcolm Gladwell because people are focused on his sideshow bob hair?
Oh, no.
Oh, I see. Oh, so somebody that's got credentials that looks weird is fine. Somebody that doesn't have credentials that looks weird to you is not fine. What's the standard? You're just afraid. I'm afraid to be called a racist. Okay, fine. Live that way. Ralph and Rantoul.
Hey, good morning. I'm wondering, is it okay if a person practices intermittent selective identification? So while I post something or... then, you know, it's okay because I'm in that class. I just have two words to respond, and I'll say it as nicely as I can so I'm not memeing anybody. Obama phone.
Oh.
Yeah, Obama
yeah,
phone.
We did play that a lot on this station. So does that make us...
Yeah.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah,
though.
we're in trouble now.
Well, are we? I don't know. Why, that's audio. I mean, well, I guess to you, that's audio blackface, but not to me. Marie, Union Grove, Wisconsin.
Hello. Taking you off speakerphone. I just wanted to say I'm tired of everyone misappropriating German. I'm of German descent, so I'm tired of everyone drinking all the beer and eating all the brats and sending their kids to kindergarten. You know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Stop appropriating our culture. Right, exactly. Yeah. All right. Stop caricaturing us. Take off that lederhosen. George in Naperville.
Man, I can't share my exaggerated, outlandish music videos of Little Richard. He was one of the founders of rock and roll, and he was out there.
I hear you, George. Thanks for the call. Sorry for your loss. Bob and Wilmette.
Hey, Dan and Mary, good morning. Yeah, I'm not as advanced with my racism. I'm not quite to the point of digital racism or digital blackface. I'm still stuck in the analog times. Does that make me just as much of a virulent racist?
Well, I mean, if you cut out a picture of the woman talking about the fire that she escaped and, you know, like physically posted it somewhere, I guess that would be, you know, the analog version of digital blackface. Thanks, Bob. Mark Palatine.
Hey, this is Mark. You hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Hey, so nice talking to you guys. Good morning. I was just on 94 East right by Skokie Road, and on the overpass there, a light-up sign that says, ain't nobody got time for a wreck. So I guess there's a racist behind there. I thought that was great. Perfect timing. I love listening to you. Have a great morning.
Thanks, Mark. Bob in Grays Lake.
Yeah, I think, taking off of Jason Whitlock's rant there, I think we should add Tookus. racism to the issue. You know, when Jesse Smollett invented it, when he pulled it out of his tuchus and just made it up out of whole cloth.
Thanks for the call, Bob. Paul in Northwest Indiana.
Good morning. Definition of digital gay bashing is posting videos of Liberace.
Yeah. Or what about Mayor Pete and his partner in the delivery room? What about that? Is that digital homophobia?
Oh, I thought that was...
Oh, and it was wonderful, pretending that one of them just gave birth.
Well, somebody gave birth. No.
Was it one of the
was
two
their
men?
Surrogate. No, it was not, but it was baby. Because it was just somebody's
sure.
Sperm.
Ew. Ray on the north side.
That word. I'm never saying it again.
Stop appropriating English. You know, that was made by whites. You know, just stop using it. That's how ridiculous we've gotten.
Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.